supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy today unveiled his first state budget plan. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. The $37.4 billion proposal raises spending by 4.2% over the current budget. Let's get into the numbers with John Reitmeier with NJ Spotlight. John, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
Where is that extra spending going?
A lot of it's going to a larger contribution into the public employee pension system. New Jersey's pension fund is one of the least and probably in as bad a condition as any in the nation. There's more money for K through 12 education. There's some more funding for New Jersey Transit, for community college tuition assistance, and for, in general, college tuition assistance grants. There's a host of increases. There's a more generous earned income tax credit for low-wage workers. There are, across the board, there are a whole lot of spending increases here.
Now, as for how to pay for it, in part, the governor is calling for a tax increase on income over $1 million. Let's listen.
The irrefutable fact is that we have 1,000 more millionaires today than we had at our pre-recession peak. And I'm sure none of them are here for the low taxes. They are here because we can offer an unmatched quality of life.
Now, John, I imagine most New Jersey residents don't have a problem with this tax because presumably most New Jersey residents are not millionaires.
Exactly. And this always polls well in New Jersey, the millionaires tax. And Murphy made no secret about wanting to increase the income tax rate on not just millionaires, but on what they earn over $1 million. The way New Jersey's income tax structure works, it's a graduated progressive structure, and what Murphy's proposing is a higher tax rate for every dollar that someone earns over $1
million. He's also proposing raising the sales tax.
Yes, so this was probably the surprise of the budget address today, although there were some indications kind of headed in that he might go in this direction. This was not part of the economic platform that Murphy had as a candidate, and there were concerns about the sales tax being restored to the 7% rate that was in effect for most of Chris Christie's tenure, but was lowered in the last few years as part of a broader tax restructuring that was enacted, if people remember, when the gas tax was increased in New Jersey a few years ago. Whereas some of Murphy's other tax proposals hit mostly the highest income earners and high-earning businesses, this will be one that hits everybody who pays the sales tax in New Jersey, whether they're New Jersey residents or they're coming here from another state.
Give Murphy credit for candor. He did say today, quote, his budget represents a sharp break from the direction taken over the past 8 years, and predictably, Republicans have plenty to say as well. Here's Senate Minority Leader Tom Kaine.
All in all, that sends a bad message to people looking to grow a business, to raise a family, to stay in New Jersey.
You know, between now and the end of June when the budget is passed, because Murphy is a new governor, is it important in part politics for Republicans to not give him much of what he wants?
Well, I think one of the big questions, so we definitely heard Republican pushback and pushback from the business community. In addition to these income and sales tax changes that we talked about, there's also some new policy as it relates to the corporate business tax. And the sales tax, I should note, will be extended to services that right now are not subject to the sales tax, like ride sharing and rentals of your housing like Airbnb. So as we go forward, there will be lobbying in the State House on some of these proposals. And even the Democrats, so the Democrats control the legislature, and the governor's a Democrat, but the speech, it was interesting to watch in the room today as the governor delivered the address. Some of the proposals weren't necessarily received warm applause from Democrats, and I think there's going to be some tension going forward, asking some of the lawmakers who have to run for office every 2 years in the assembly to jump in with some of these tax hikes, especially something like the sales tax.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
NJ Spotlight's John Reitmeier on Newsworks Tonight. Following the massacre of 17 students in Parkland, Florida, school safety is once again front page news. It's been almost 19 years since Columbine, one of the most infamous school shootings. And since then, WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports the school safety landscape has shifted dramatically, but not as dramatically as some expected or hoped.
It was one of the worst tragedies in the history of American education. On December 1, 1958, a fire broke out at Our Lady of Angels School in Chicago, Illinois.
One of the nation's worst ever shocks the country. A tragedy struck a Catholic parochial school just 18 minutes before classes were to be dismissed for the day.
When the smoke cleared, 92 children and three nuns were dead. The disaster became a turning point in fire safety, leading to new building codes, sprinklers, drills, and protocols.
When that fire occurred down in Chicago, change started happening immediately.
Aaron Venata is telling me about the Our Lady of Angels fire while driving around rural western Pennsylvania looking for a good cell signal.
Not real sure where I'm at, but there's not too much around.
When Venata isn't serving as a school police officer just outside Pittsburgh, he crisscrosses the area training students and teachers on how to deal with violent intruders. The Columbine shooting happened just 6 months before his first job as a school-based officer.
Immediately following that, you thought you'd see a lot more change, a lot quicker, but it didn't really happen that way.
There hasn't been a major school fire in 60 years. So why, Venata wonders, haven't ghastly school shootings gone the way of ghastly school fires? He says there have been changes. For instance, police response has completely flipped. Instead of waiting for SWAT teams to arrive, police are trained to immediately confront the shooter, and potential victims are told to run or offer resistance instead of simply hiding. Jennifer Thompson says laws have changed, too.
It's actually a pretty interesting trend.
Thompson is a researcher at the Education Commission of the States, which tracks school policies across the country. After Columbine, she says, new laws tended to focus on how schools deal with student behavior.
So, for example, strengthening codes of conduct, modifying laws regarding suspension and expulsion of disruptive or threatening students.
Delaware, for instance, changed its process for reporting crimes committed by students. 13 years later, after the Columbine shooting, another wave of legislation emerged, this time following the killing of 20 elementary school students in Newtown, Connecticut.
And at that time, we saw a lot more focus on firearms in schools and also a lot of focus on emergency preparedness.
Delaware changed the type of safety drills required. New Jersey created a task force to improve school security. And Pennsylvania started a grant program so districts could improve safety infrastructure. For example, the Pennsbury School District in Bucks County used the money to fund trainings and purchase walkie-talkies. The district also installed secure lobbies in each of its schools so visitors are screened before they enter, says Director of Pupil Services Elizabeth Aldridge.
Those things did not exist in all of our buildings 20 years ago.
Other districts have added card scan systems for staff, updated locks, purchased metal detectors, and of course, required lots of new trainings. Pennsbury now does intruder drills every quarter.
Even a kindergartner will be in a class that has an intruder drill.
Seemingly, though, intruder drills haven't been as effective as fire drills. Amanda Klinger with the Educator School Safety Network says that's partially because shooters are harder to prepare for than fires. But she also says the response to school shootings has been slower and less coordinated than the response to the Our Lady of Angels fire. As an example, she points to all the different types of drills that schools do: intruder drills, active shooter drills, many with their own distinct flavors.
How can we come to some sort of consistency so that everybody is increasing their level of preparedness?
Others say the root problems are gun laws and gun culture in America. That view is the driving force behind student walkouts taking place across the country tomorrow. The rallies will be another reminder that, while school safety looks different than it did 20 years ago, it faces a lot of the same challenges. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Many high school students in our region will be participating in those walkouts tomorrow, and last night we heard from one of them, a Philadelphia student whose father was shot and paralyzed in a carjacking. Tonight, we head out to Lawrenceville, New Jersey, where Lawrenceville High School senior Catherine Kilday plans to meet with State Senator Shirley Turner later this week to discuss her ideas on how to tackle gun violence.
So I think I want to talk to her about, one, what I think my school is doing that's working. So things that I appreciate that my school does. We just changed our security measures so we can no longer go in between the different wings of the buildings, which is a great change. And then I also want to talk to her about what I personally believe. So possibly getting an armed police officer. How does that line up with how the people in New Jersey tend to vote or agree or what they want their taxes to go towards? So I'm very excited to vote. I'm very into politics, and I'm really excited to be able to participate. Gun control is definitely going to be a big thing for me, and I think in this upcoming, the midterm elections is going to be a huge deal. I would say it's definitely in like my top five of issues because it's a life or death type of situation. So I think it needs to be addressed, and all the different sides need to be discussed. It's very sad, but I've actually spoken with a lot of my classmates who've said, you know, when you're sitting in class, you think, what would I do if it were to happen right now? You know, how would I get out of the situation? So I guess participating in drills, trying to be aware of your surroundings, like walking down the hallway, like what do you see? Do you see people being bullied, or do you feel that certain people are being like attacked in a certain way that could build this pressure to allow them to, you know, just go off and commit this horrible act? I definitely think, at least from what I've experienced growing up in this time, that Parkland feels different. Every time we have a shooting, it's horrible. It's just scary and frightening, and you feel horrible for the victims. But I do feel like our attention span as a nation is so, it changes so quickly. So, you know, this horrible thing happened, and then this and this, and it just keeps going. But I feel like with Parkland, at least in my community where I'm growing up, is definitely making people talk. And people that I haven't heard speak out about it before, people that aren't even really into politics are sharing their opinions, which I think is important. So I think in the future, there's definitely hope. And now that we're the young people that are going to be going to office and everything, I think that definitely helps.
That's Catherine Kilday, a senior at Lawrenceville High School in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The interview was conducted by Dana DeFilippo. In the wake of the Parkland, Florida shooting, alumni of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School scattered across the country immediately sought each other out to help their alma mater. Using Facebook, they formed regional groups to organize fundraising efforts. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports on the first local benefit by MSD graduates, a comedy show.
When 17 people were killed by a gunman at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida a month ago, it took just a couple hours for the school's alumni to locate one another on social media across the country, about 11,000 strong. They began to coordinate events to benefit the school and the victims' families. Rebecca Salas graduated from MSD in 1996, moved to Philadelphia last year. An experienced improv comedian, the first thing she did when she moved here was find the local comedy scene.
I also did not know one single human being in this city before I moved here. And improv is a very social outlet because it's a team sport. Everyone has to work really closely together.
After the shooting, when MSD alumni started to mobilize, Salas discovered there are at least 30 other people in the Philadelphia area from her old high school. She became a point person to rally local support for Stoneman Douglas. On Sunday, Salas coordinated an evening of improv comedy at the Philly Improv Theater in Rittenhouse Square. There's nothing funny about school shootings. The jokes on stage will not refer to the tragedy in Florida. Salas is using laughter to build community with the audience, many of whom will be MSD alumni.
I have lovely friends up here that have been trying really hard to be supportive, but I think there's some comfort in being able to connect with people who are feeling the same way. And I think all of the alumni are feeling very much that this is personal for us and that this happened to all of us. We all share the responsibility for helping and for promoting change.
All the proceeds from the comedy show will go to a fund to help pay for current students of MSD to attend a march in Washington, D.C. next week. Local alumni are planning a similar march in Philadelphia on the same day. It's one of over 700 events planned worldwide for March 24th. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
This week, Philadelphia Congressman Bob Brady announced that he'd sponsor a special kind of legislation, a private bill on behalf of one family of undocumented immigrants. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that while this type of legislation has been used in the past as a last-ditch resort to give an immigrant legal status in the United States, recent changes make the long-shot effort even longer.
Carmela Apolonio Hernandez and her four children, aged 9 to 15, moved into the Church of the Advocate in North Philadelphia last December, surrounded by supporters. I'll help you carry on. Her family decided to take sanctuary in a place where federal immigration officers won't make arrests. They'd lost their asylum case in immigration court and faced deportation to Mexico. Hernandez says drug traffickers extorted and killed her family members there, so they can't go back. With few legal options, her supporters have gotten creative.
We're basically using all tools at our disposal, organizing, community support, legal.
That's the family's attorney, David Bennion. He says one of those tactics is a private bill. Private bills have to go through all the same hoops as a regular public bill, but they create narrow laws benefiting one person or a small group of people. Democratic Congressman Bob Brady says Hernandez's story moved him to sponsor such a bill.
If I found out that they got deported and a month or two from now some harm came to them, and I didn't do anything, that's not a good feeling.
If getting one of these bills is rare, passing one is even rarer. From 1986 to 2013, only about 170 private bills became law, most of them focusing on getting individual immigrants a green card. Then last year, the head of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement announced it would no longer automatically slow down a deportation just because a private bill had passed out of committee. William Stock is the immediate past president of the American Immigration Attorneys Association.
This is a way of pushing back against Congress's constitutional right of oversight and of the ability to direct the immigration enforcement agencies.
He says private bills have always been symbolic, a way of pointing out things Congress may have missed during the legislative process. So even if they don't take effect, they still send a message. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
March Madness is in the forecast for the next couple of weeks. Let's learn which local teams stand a chance of getting caught up in the Philadelphia Eagles' tailwind. Joining me to get a sense of it all is Inquirer and Daily News sports writer Joe Giuliano. Joe, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Good to be back, Dave. Thank you.
As far as the forecast goes, this would be an unprecedented storm if the Penn Quakers prevail Thursday afternoon.
Exactly. With the Super Bowl champion Eagles, it was all about the underdog, and you couldn't find a bigger underdog if you tried in the NCAA tournament than the Penn Quakers. Penn has a 16 seed, and they will go up against the number one seed Kansas Jayhawks, a basketball program with rich history and national championships and all that. And the stat to remember that since the seedings began in 1985, no number 16 seed has ever defeated a number one seed. And, of course, the philosophy at Penn right now is, why not us?
They say they're playing with the house money, but they were lucky to just emerge as far as they've gotten. They just squeaked by Harvard in the championship game.
Yeah, it was a terrific game. Thankfully for Penn, it was at the Palestra, and the crowd was pretty one-sided in favor of the Quakers. But it was a very exciting game. Harvard got out to a big lead in the first half, and then Penn had reduced that by halftime, and then went out to a big lead of its own in the second half, and Harvard cut into that. So it was a real game that was very exciting, ebbs and flows, and Penn came out victorious by three at the end and earned their ticket to the NCAA tournament.
So let's move on to Villanova. Actually, it's later this hour that a game will be played to determine who Villanova will first face.
That's correct. So tonight, LIU Brooklyn will play Radford, which is a team in Virginia, for the right to play Villanova in a 16-versus-1 game on Thursday night in Pittsburgh.
And then on the likelihood that Villanova will prevail, who looks like a tough opponent to get out of the East? Number two, Purdue, perchance?
Well, Purdue will be tough, but before that, and I've covered Villanova for so long, I'm programmed in the one-game-at-a-time cliche. If they do get by the LIU-Brooklyn-Radford winner, they will play the winner of Virginia Tech versus Alabama. Now, Virginia Tech is a team that's coached by a gentleman by the name of Buzz Williams, who coached Marquette for a while, and they played Villanova regularly. Williams believes on a very pressing defense, but his team is kind of up and down. They've lost some really easy games that they should have won, but then they defeated Virginia, which is the number one team in the country, at Virginia. They were the only team to beat the number one team at its home court. And they've also beaten North Carolina and Duke. So Virginia Tech would seem to be a formidable second-round matchup. And then you'd have a Purdue. That would be the dream matchup in the region, would be Villanova-Purdue, the one against two, in the for the right to go to the Final Four. And Villanova played Purdue last year out at Purdue and defeated them. But Villanova lost a couple of good players from that team, and Purdue's lost a couple of good players from their team. But it should be still be an exciting matchup if both teams get that far.
13 appearances in 14 seasons certainly is a mark of consistency. Would you take it a step further and, in this day and age, call it as close to a dynasty as there might be for college basketball?
Villanova is one of the elite programs in the country. I think that's safe to say without hesitation. The fact that they've won a national championship 2 years ago obviously puts them in the right up there among the upper-level programs in history. And the fact that that was their second national championship, having won their first in 1985. You have your Kansas and your Duke and your Kentucky and all those teams. But Villanova can claim its rightful spot with any of them among the best.
Joe, with that, before I let you go, any advice for our WHYY cohort filling out their brackets right around now?
Oh, man. People who always do worse in the worst in the brackets are the people who cover college basketball for a living, like myself. So I would not dare to submit any expertise to those people.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Dave.
Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News sports writer Joe Giuliano on Newsworks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. Newsworks Tonight.